It's important that I give this talk anyway because I started this whole thing on stream entry. And very briefly, as I mentioned at the day long on Saturday, a stream enter is a sotupanna in Pali, and it's not a topic that is often addressed. And I asked the people at Saturday's retreat, why do you think that is? At least it's not addressed as a stream enter or here's what you do. Why do you think that is? Nobody has it. Well, a guy at the day long got it, and he said, because you're establishing a goal for yourself. And that is it. I mean, as soon as I say, okay, you want to be on the path, and this is what you need to do, all of a sudden you've got this goal. And if you don't set these standards, you feel that you have failed. And that's not what this path is all about. It's actually setting the conditions that allow the mind to know freedom, not do this, this, and this, and the mind will know freedom. It's like establishing an ethical practice, you know, working with the five precepts, and this will help the mind to stabilize. Because you don't have to worry about who you have, you know, done something bad to or lied to or cheated or that kind of thing. So Sotipatthana is the first step on a path to awakening. And the second step is a Sakadagama. The third is a Nagami. And the fourth is an Arhant. Those are the four stages, and they are, quote, measured, I hate using these words, but by the 10 fetters. And we're going to talk today about the second fetter. Talked about self-identity at the day long on Saturday, and how clinging to self-identity does nothing but cause you a whole lot of pain. It's really the cause of all of our suffering, and it's the very first fetter we have to begin to uproot. It does not mean that you have no self-identity. It doesn't mean that at all. You have to have a self-identity to live in the world. But how attached are you to how you think about yourself? How attached are you to what you present to the world? How do you feel like a failure when you don't present what you think you should be presenting to the world? And then your whole interior life is another set of identities. So that's what we discussed in great detail. The second of the fetters to be uprooted is doubt, which I find very interesting because doubt on the other lists is way at the end. But it's second, actually, in some lists it's third, some it's second, but it's second or third. I'm saying second for this talk. I really like the 10 fetters because they are good guides for really what ails us. You know, forget about you got to do this, this, and this to achieve stream entry. They're just really interesting and a good guide. So, as I mentioned, not clinging to self-identity, that's a good thing to think about in our practice. But way at the end of the 10 fetters, number 8 is conceit, which is interesting. So I'm surmising, this is only me surmising, that at the beginning of the path, we actually start seeing how suffering is caused by self-identity, and we start practicing with it, and we start looking at what we're doing to ourselves and others, and then way at close to the end, we've perfected it. That's the way I'm thinking about it. And actually the same with doubt, which is the second fetter, but at the very end is ignorance. So it appears to me if doubt is way at the beginning, it's something we've got to uproot. We start the process, and then at the end, ignorance is wisdom. There is no more doubt. So it's the final step. The third, by the way, is uprooting rites and rituals. And to me, this means dogma. Actually sticking to something and saying, this is the way it is. Joseph Goldstein had said, certainty is no indication of truth. And I love that statement. So we're going to talk about doubt in terms of uprooting it to start to awaken. And actually turning towards it and actually knowing when doubt is present. There is nothing wrong with doubt, which is what we'll be going into. I have at the bottom of my email, I think Laura Rosenthal had it on hers, so I copied it, but I thought it was such a great statement. In seeking wisdom, you are wise. In imagining you have attained it, you're a fool. And this is by Rabbi Ben Azai. And I thought, boy, that is such a terrific statement. And I think really describes this path as well, which also reminds me of something Gil Fronsdahl said when he gave a talk on stream entry and, you know, people, various people saying they believed they had attained the state or maybe even higher. And he said, however, conceit is number 8 on the path, which means you never have to even think about this. This isn't a topic of conversation. So you have to stop and think if somebody's saying, you know, I'm well on my way. Conceit is there. So maybe not so much. Doubt has many faces, and some are very, very, very subtle, including, and I'll go into actually 3 kinds of doubt, 2 that are traditional, and 1 I read in an essay by Philip Moffat, which I hadn't thought about, but I thought he had some good thoughts on it, so I'm going to bring that up too. So doubt could be a nonspecific anxiety. I think this is an interesting psychological state. It almost sounds like dukkha, unease, where you just have this doubt about kind of everything. What am I doing? Why am I doing this practice? What am I doing with my life? That kind of just low ease that you might not even be able to define. And one person wrote, it's knowing there's something better than your own ego structure, but you don't know what it is. You just know there's something else there, and you just have a sense of almost anxiety about it. The Buddha had taught that doubt is one of the hindrances of the mind. You know, it's the 5th of the 5 hindrances. And it was something to be uprooted. It's on many lists, 3 that I can think of. And one of the 5 hindrances are, does anybody remember and want to recite them? What? Nobody knows the 5 hindrances? All right. The very first is greed or sensual desire, lust, just wanting more and more of something. The second is its opposite, which would be aversion, that's right, or hatred, not wanting it this way. And we can see this in meditation. Ooh, that was a really good meditation session. I want more of that, which guarantees what? It'll never happen, right? And then that was the worst meditation session I ever had. You know, that better never happen again. And then the third is sloth and torpor. And sloth means the body is fatigued. And torpor is the mind is fatigued. And we've all heard of the various ways of dealing with that. Standing up, throwing water in your face, walking, you know, getting your energy level up. The fourth is restlessness and anxiety. Restlessness is problems with the past, and anxiety is concerned about the future. And then the fifth one is doubt, the mother of all the hindrances, according to some teachers. Because when you have doubt, you can't engage. And you can see why that would be happening. Why should I be even doing this? Why am I looking at this? Why am I trying to get my energy level up? What's the point? So, but the good thing about mindfulness is, and this is why it's so important, when doubt is present, do you know when it's present? And that's mindfulness. Do you actually see doubt is present? You know, for me, that sounds kind of like a stupid question, maybe. But you think about it, how many of us actually take the time to do that when doubt is present? Instead, do we just go along with the storyline and just keep going with it? That's, I'm afraid, what many of us do, because it's easier than actually stopping and saying, doubt is actually present in the mind. So traditionally, there's two kinds of doubts. But Philip Moffat said there's a third, and I'm going to talk about his third as well. But the first kind is the good kind of doubt. This practice encourages doubt. This is why this practice is so different from other spiritual traditions. Doubting is good. It's skillful. As long as it's done in the right way, and that you are looking at what you are doubting in a pragmatic. Remember, I gave a talk on asking the right questions a while ago? This is where this comes in. Asking the right questions, knowing what do you want to know, is so, so important. Doubt will also help us cultivate the don't know mind. And the don't know mind, and I can guarantee this, for a long time I thought I had to have all the answers, especially being in a teaching position and mentoring people, have to know what to say. And to finally admit, I don't know, and to say, I don't know, is a relief. It's accepting doubt, accepting there might not be an answer, and it's okay. It's don't know mind. And for many of it, I know when I go, I've mentioned this a number of times, occasionally I go Monday night to Valley Streams Zen Service, and one of my favorite teachers is Mio, who has said, I'm not the answer man. And as soon as he said that, I thought, I really like him. I like somebody who admits, I'm not the answer man. I don't have all the answers. But he has said he can help you formulate the questions that you need to ask. The value of faith and the value of doubt. Faith can be a really dirty word in Buddhist circles. But when we start seeing this practice start working, that is developing faith. I heard somebody, probably NPR because that's all I listen to, say, I think it was on there, they said faith is like putting your hand on a staircase in a dark room. You can't see the stairs, but you can feel where you're going, even though you can't see the end. And I think that is probably what is true with our practice. When we start practicing and we notice after maybe a couple months, years, whatever, things are better. You're not reacting in the way you used to that caused your harm to yourself and others. It might be subtle things, but you just noticed a difference. I know one of the Spirit Rock teachers was asked by her husband, and I can't remember her name now. But anyway, he said, you've been practicing for 40 or 50 years. And how has it benefited you? And she said, I'm kind. And he said, that's all? And she said, isn't that enough? I mean, to be able to say, I'm kind, God, that's huge, you know, after so many years of practice. So we don't know everything that is going to be happening in our practice. This is where faith comes in. Faith is not like the, how do you pronounce it, Abrahamic traditions, where you have to have faith. You know, if you're a Christian, perhaps, you know, have to have faith in Jesus Christ as your Lord and Savior. I was listening to an interview with a atheist Muslim tonight before I came here. She's founded this society for people who are Muslim, who no longer accept Islam as a safe place to go. And the interviewer was saying, is your life in danger? And she said, absolutely. They can't have to keep their meeting secret. They can't publicize anything because there's a fatwa on her for doing this. This is faith that is just, you know, this is ridiculous faith. You know, being so certain you're right that you're willing to kill others because of your dogma. This is not the kind of faith that we want to develop or the Buddha said we should develop. It is faith in our own experience. You remember the sutta where the Buddha took a handful of leaves off the trees or picked them up off the ground. And he said, what I've taught you is this, but all the leaves on the tree are what is available to you. So you have to have faith that that is going to happen. And I'll be mentioning this at the end. I think all of you, I know all of you, have had an awakening experience. You've had an experience of ease and contentment and happiness. And that is what is available with ongoing practice. The problem with probably a lot of you is you don't recognize when you've had awakening experience because we're all so busy and we don't take time. So that's something else that gets rid of doubt. If you take the time to enjoy those times of bliss. So when I have the Saturday day long, Terry mentioned, you know, those times when she was walking in nature. You know, somebody else mentioned playing with children and how the self-identity completely disappears and she is just completely with that. Playing with your dogs. I mean, there's all kinds of things, not just in meditation, in life, that we need to stop and experience and really appreciate the joy that's available and then develop faith that more of this is available. The more I start seeing, I'm mindful about what I'm doing. So life is filled with doubt. It's always going to come up. It's always going to be part of our life. In fact, sometimes doubt is absolutely necessary. When do you think doubt is absolutely necessary? What situation would you be in where you need to doubt? Yeah, that's certainly true. What else? Yeah. Yeah, to be naive and be taken advantage of because you didn't doubt. Is that really going on? Yeah, somebody else had something?
When you're wrong.
That's right. When you're wrong, that's right. And maybe even having that wisp of doubt even when you think you're right. And being willing to accept that maybe there's another way as well.
Yeah, well, I always think I'm right. And I'm wrong a lot. That's a feature of being wrong for me. Just thinking that I'm right.
I think So doubt in this tradition is not only encouraged, it is absolutely essential. And the more you start practicing, you're going to have some doubts about, am I doing it right? Am I doing it wrong? What's going on? As you learn more, you're going to also wonder about something else, you know, as your mind opens to new possibilities. So doubt is a firm part of this tradition, which is, I know is one of the reasons I was initially attracted to it. Any tradition that says question, you know, and question some more, I think has got a lot going for it. And regarding faith, the Buddha said, even in this tradition, don't put everything, don't become dogmatic, even about this tradition. And I think Thich Nhat Hanh said it best in this paragraph. He said, do not be idolatrous about or bound to any doctrine, theory, or ideology, even Buddhist ones. Buddhist systems of thought are guiding means. They are not absolute truth. Do not think the knowledge you possess is changeless. Avoid being narrow-minded and bound to present views. Learn and practice non-attachment from views in order to be open to receive others' viewpoints. Truth is found in life and not merely in conceptual knowledge. Be ready to learn through your entire life and to observe reality in yourself and in the world at all times. So even in this practice, at some point when we are fully awakened, we let it go. That's the analogy of the raft the Buddha talked about. You use the raft to cross the ocean or the stream, and once you get to the island that you're going to, you don't carry the raft with you on your head as you wander around, you let it go. I don't think any of us are at that point yet, but there has been. And that's where faith comes in, that there has been. There's a teacher, Indian teacher called Ramana Maharishi. Has anybody heard of him? Apparently he's a kind of a Hindu saint. And his teachings were all on self-inquiry. So when people came, kind of like what we did on Saturday with, you know, looking at self-identity. Just constantly looking at, who am I? Who am I? And he had one devotee who just was completely taken by his teachings and gave up everything to come live in the ashram, gave his money to Maharishi, left his family, left his job, everything. And he said to Maharishi, I've broken all ties with my family and my former life. I am devoted to you. And Maharishi responds, your firm conviction brought you here. Where is the room for doubt? So even in that tradition, he's talking about skillful doubt, always looking at our experience. How can I make this better? How can I make the world better? So the opposite of this kind of doubt is nihilistic or unskillful doubt. It is said this doubt can be seen better in others than yourself. So I think maybe all of us maybe know a person that is just negative about almost everything, nihilistic, dogmatic about their negativity. No matter what is said to them, they're not going to change. They have decided this is it, and even given scientific proof, they're not going to change. The third kind of doubt is, and this is from Philip Moffat, he calls it reactive doubt. And he said, this is a kind of a malady in everyday life, and it is a doubt about your own ability and your own worth. And when that doubt is there, it can affect everything. You've all heard me talking, I've been talking about Sam Harris a lot because I've gotten on a Sam Harris kick for the past couple of months. And I was listening to a talk he gave on doubt, and he thinks this kind of reactive doubt is actually an emotion. It will come and go, and it's a type of depression. And as I started thinking about depression and doubt, you know, that makes sense. That would, according to Philip Moffitt, it would come from, you know, an unfulfilled ambition or a failure that is just permeating your life. And you just have doubt. It's not always, but whenever the thought of that failure comes up, doubt about what you should be doing comes up. And it, like everything else, comes from causes and conditions. So working with doubt and turning negative doubt into investigative doubt. As I said earlier, you need to know when doubt is present, not just go along with it, not just go along with the mind state. I came up with this list myself, and you might have some others, but you know, I just stopped and thought about my own experience. And especially, you know, many years ago when I first started this practice, and I had pretty severe doubt. And I realized it was from inadequate knowledge and or experience. And this means, and I remember doing this, I have been sitting and practicing for 3 months. Now, why aren't I awakened? Why aren't I doing so much better? What's wrong? All I do is have body aches. This isn't working for me. This is inadequate knowledge. It's, you know, what can you say? You know, so many people, when they start this practice, do that and don't realize that it is a cumulative practice that will make a difference. But it's taken you a lifetime to get to the point where you are right now, and it's going to take the rest of your life to get out of it. If you're a Sotipanna, you will recognize there's no going back. So if you decide, I don't want to do this anymore, but the cat's out of the bag, you have seen what is possible, and you know what is true, and you can't abandon it any longer, even if you want to. That's one of the definitions of somebody who's well on the path, is you can no longer go back, even if you want to. Even if you say, and I've heard many of you say, this is a lot of work. Yeah, it is. But what choice do you have? It's the way it is. Another one is when people have doubt is, well, I thought I'd have pleasant results. I thought I'd be happy all the time. I thought all my problems would be solved if I practiced enough. Well, this is not the Dharma. The Dharma never said that. The Dharma said there's going to be impermanence of all things. There's going to be happiness and there's going to be sadness. Both. The practice is not attaching to either of them, accepting this is the way it is now, and not thinking this is a definition of me. Not easy to do, but that's exactly what the practice is about. So somebody says, I want pleasant results, you're going to be disappointed, because life is still going to happen. It's not going to stop. People are going to die, they're going to be sick, you're going to fall down, you're going to get a stomach ache, you're going to lose your job. All these things are going to happen due to causes and conditions beyond your control. But understanding that this too will pass, and I don't have to attach to it, and I don't have to create an identity over it. That's your practice. That's not easy, but once you know it, you can't go back. Another doubt comes about a teacher. I think all of us have moved from one teacher to another, you know, depending on where we are in our own practice and what's going on with us, or perhaps personalities, you know, with we really like some teachers and we don't understand others. It, boy, the example, and I know some of you know this, when I first heard John Travis 20 years ago, I had no idea what he was talking about. Not a clue. And everybody was talking about, God, this guy is just, wow, he's something. I'm thinking, what? I don't get it. And it's because my practice was so elementary and so new, I was just seeing his words. I wasn't seeing the heart behind it at the time. And it's kind of like the saying about kids, you know, the older I get, the smarter my mother got, kind of thing. And the more I practice, the more, and I'm sure this is true of you too, the more sense John made, you know, till the point is you just can't wait to hear him. Because you can read between the lines because of your own practice. Doubt could have easily set in, but there was a ring of truth to it, and that was, for me, my faith. Doubt as to whether this practice is really for everyone. I'm curious to see what you had to say about that. Is this practice for everyone? What do you think? Yeah, Bob. Mm-hmm. Right. Yep. I've read that exact same thing. Yeah. 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 That was me. Yeah. Yes, at the time, and I've told this story, my husband had died and I was in deep grief, and I couldn't sit because I just couldn't keep my mind off my grief. And I talked to him and he said, I want you to just go walk. He said, don't sit. And it was the best advice I got. So I did a lot of walking meditation and then was able to sit after a couple months. So, yeah. Anything else you can think of?
So it kind of seems, in my mind, I think this practice, this is a good practice for anyone. But again, we have to come to it ourselves.
Exactly.
And that's kind of true of any kind of spiritual practice, certainly, but also it used to be, learning about how to do something in your life, in your home, or in your yard, or something like that. The example of depressed people, perhaps, or that sort of thing, that, so certainly it's not for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
But do we think about the way the world is today with world leaders? Yeah, I always come to this, I don't know if it's relevant or not, but if the world leaders would take a beginning meditation class, yeah, we'd have a lot smoother, more beautiful work, you know, and a lot less work.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's pretty much an unanswerable question.
You get yours. Yeah, Bob.
I think that's
then there's this whole other stuff about, you know, there's a lot of belief tradition about, you know, like a cosmology about, you know, how many bees, you know, how many bees are around the earth, building on water, and through that stuff. I even think the concept of screen up through where, you know, once you're screening through another bunch of screen up and keep your eyes, you only get 7 more, like, not 6, not 8. You know, it's like that seems more like a cosmology than a belief system. Tremendous amount of doubt about that.
I agree with you, and I also appreciate the Buddha and what he said to the Kalamas in the Kalama Sutta, that experience it for yourself. Don't believe what teachers say, don't believe what you read in books, don't believe any of this until you experience it yourself. And if it alleviates suffering for yourself and others, then practice it. And that, to me, I agree with you, the whole cosmology thing, it makes no sense to me. It seems like a mythology that came out of India that apparently was there prior to the Buddha. So, no, I don't have any use for it. What I have use for is the Noble Eightfold Path, because I found that works. Exactly. Yeah. And even when you talked about Sotipanna, you know, and this whole stream entry thing, I don't think, and I think I said this when I did the introduction a couple weeks ago, I don't think it's linear like this, you know, cut and dry and here it is and step one, step two, and here's your yardstick. But I think it's a very interesting psychological measurement of what's going on, and especially with the first three, self-identity, you know, and how much we cling to it, how we deal with doubt, and how we cling to dogma. I think these are all really, really helpful aspects of our practice to look at. Yeah, I totally agree with you. Waking up?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We differentiate things that are practical and true from other religiosity.
Yeah, as I said the day long and last talk I gave on this, I think he's very interesting because he says he's an atheist, but he spent over 3 years in silent meditation, and Joseph Goldstein's one of his best friends. But, you know, he says he's not espousing anything in particular. Yeah, right. But he also doesn't want to have any religious beliefs, and it's kind of along what you were saying, Bob, you know, this has been really helpful, but this whole cosmology thing is difficult. And, yeah, I don't think necessary for us to understand or experience in the here and now.
Yeah,
Ginger.
Mm-hmm. happens is that when you start accepting, that which it is easier to really accept what is very, very difficult to do, even though people say the word, and the way you say it, in such a sweet way that people just accept. So if you get to that level, you can really accept. And I think it's come a long way.
Acceptance, yeah, is huge. And also willing to let things go. It is huge. Yeah. Thank you. So doubt is an unavoidable part of life experience, and it is it's a did somebody have their hand up? I'm sorry. Margaret.
I'm not sure you
have to question. Yes. Yeah, and I'm wondering if, because you bring up an interesting point, excuse me, it's almost like, for me, except for people who really have some severe psychological problems, yeah, for other people, you know, when I teach meditation to people or somebody asks me to mentor them, the first thing I will ask them, and I've done it here, I did it about 7 months ago, and I had three women come in, and they wanted to learn meditation. And I said, are you willing to sit in silence for 15 minutes and do nothing? And I said, if you are, come back, and I will give you the next step. And they all emailed me and said they didn't want to. They didn't want to sit in silence for 15 minutes. For me, this is like a criteria now. Do you really want to learn this? Can you be quiet for 15 minutes without your phone and everything else? And they couldn't. And this is not unusual. Does that mean they are not people who should? No, I think they definitely should, but they're certainly not ready to. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Boogie.
Stop laughing because I'm thinking of a particular friend of mine. One other friend, he's having to confiscate his phone. When you spend time there, it's just a constant abusement. And this fellow was saying he was interested in learning about meditation, but he kept having excuses for not doing it or reasons why. And then finally, the three of us, one time, we sat down to do it, and we said, just 5 minutes. That's all we asked for, 5 minutes. And I swear, it was about a minute or a minute and a half, and he just got up and started doing this.
Exactly. That's exactly it. And I think that is for me, because frankly, I don't want to waste my time anymore. I hate to put it that way, but, you know, spending 45 minutes talking to someone and they really didn't want to hear this. So can you sit for 15 minutes, you know, just quiet, not meditating, just quiet. And if they can't, I don't think they're ready to take on this practice. That's a criteria I've been using. So. Stephen Batchelor wrote a book in 1990. It's one of my favorite books. It's called The Faith to Doubt. And Stephen Batchelor is a secular Buddhist, although he says he's a Zen practitioner now. But he's kind of like what you were talking about, Bob, you know. No rebirth, no cosmology, he just goes in for the stuff that alleviates suffering. I read the book and really enjoyed it. And he said that after a 10-day Goenka retreat, he decided to investigate doubt more deeply. And He decided to do a 3-month Korean Zen retreat where investigation of doubt is the practice. That is what they do. And according to that tradition, 3 factors have to be cultivated: great faith, great doubt, and great courage. So, and then they use a Chinese saying that's Chinese Chan saying, great doubt, great enlightenment, no doubt, no enlightenment, which I also like. And then I think for those of us who have been practicing for a long time, and John Travis, when I had an interview with him years ago, and we were talking about this, we talked about the dark night of the soul. And I don't want to harp on this because maybe many of you have not experienced it, but John posited that possibly after 10 years of practice, this is what could take place. When I talked to Gil about this, he kind of said the same thing. And dark night of the soul, and I'm not going to go too deeply into it, but there is a really primal doubt that takes place. And I think it's because it's partially uprooting identity, and you really start seeing the impermanence of everything, and now you're not sure if you want to see anymore. I think that's the best way I could put it. I know I had been practicing about 10 years when this happened, and this was about 10 years ago, and I had real doubts about should I continue. And this is when you need a teacher to talk to and explain your situation, and they can put it in right perspective. But it also, I'm bringing this up because some of you might go through this, and it's okay. It's to be expected. Read St. John of the Cross's Dark Night of the Soul, because he went through this from a Christian perspective. And it's just what happens when you are really dedicated to your practice and do retreat work and that kind of thing. So we have about 5 minutes. I wanted to ask, what sort of doubt have you experienced? What took place and what did you do about it, if anything? And I hope somebody will contribute because I learned so much from all of you. Oh, that is great. Thank you so much, Margaret. I think that is so helpful. And God, that is so true, too. Yeah, Ian. I'll answer and then Margaret, please answer. I don't think taking a break, but you might want to change your strategy. And again, this is where a teacher can be helpful. It's like the example I gave about grief and I couldn't sit anymore. I still wanted to practice, but sitting was not the appropriate thing to do any longer at that point. I went back, obviously, to sitting, but... I think... never drop it. Don't drop it. But a change of strategy is probably in order. Margaret, what are your thoughts?
I think didn't want to just run away from it. I didn't want to know I did it from the point of view of the people. And I didn't want to know
Yes, that's right. Yeah, thank you, Margaret. You explained that well. And that does bring up, again, teachers. You know, if you're hitting a spell where you're not getting what you think you need to out of a teacher, go to a different teacher. Here, I think we're lucky. We've got three sanghas. And SBMG has all these teachers, you know. Try something else. See if that's going to work. But I agree with Margaret. You can't unknow what you know. And there's no going back. Yeah. Anybody else have doubt in how they dealt with it? Yeah, Claire. Yes. Yeah, just like life. Anybody else have anything they want to share for the goodness of the rest of us? Yeah, Joe. It's really difficult when you have that experience. I've got a friend who's a devout practitioner, but she was involved in a cult for many years and was so hurt by what took place that she will not go to anything like this. Not where there's teachers or, you know, somebody's telling you what to do or anything. I've tried to convince her, but no. And that might be bringing up, is this practice for everyone? She is practicing, but she's not practicing in community. And I think she's missing something. But yeah. All right, any other final comments? Yes, Subiki.
Yep.
Yeah.
I just don't let it go.
That is probably what Philip Moffitt is calling reactive doubt. And you're also reacting to life, you know, and challenges and everything else, and it's also spilling over into your practice as well. And his recommendation from what I read was look at the causes and conditions of everything. You know, nothing's happening in a vacuum. Investigate it. Yeah. And keep your good practice going. Yeah. I think so. But that's very good. Thank you, Martha. All right, if there's nothing else, it's 2 minutes to nine. I'm not spoiling my record. Get us all out of here at 9 o'clock. Let's do a final dedication of merit and metta. So may the questions we ask about ourselves and our practice, may we be able to formulate them so that they can provide comfort and knowledge and the impetus to keep moving forward. And may our discussion tonight and our honest reflections be given freely to all living beings. May our honest concern about waking up for ourselves and all others be given freely to all sentient beings. And may we in this room, and may all beings everywhere, completely wake up in this very lifetime. So thank you all for coming.